guidebooks and make your wonderful plans. The Colosseum, the Michelangelo David, the gondolas in Venice. You may learn some handy phrases in Italian. It's all very exciting. After months of eager anticipation, the day finally arrives. You pack your bags and off you go. Several hours later, the plane lands. The flight attendant comes in and says, "Welcome to Holland." "Holland?" you say. "What do you mean, Holland? I signed up for Italy. I'm supposed to be in Italy. All my life, I've dreamed of going to Italy." But there's been a change in the flight plan. They've landed in Holland, and there you must stay. The important thing is that they haven't taken you to a horrible, disgusting, filthy place full of pestilence, famine, and disease. It's just a different place. So you must go out and buy new guidebooks, and you must learn a whole new language, and you will meet a whole new group of people you would never have met. It's just a different place. It's slower paced than Italy, less flashy than Italy. But after you've been there for a while and you catch your breath, you look around and you begin to notice that Holland has windmills, and Holland has tulips. Holland even has Rembrandts. But everyone you know is busy coming and going from Italy, and they're all bragging about what a wonderful time they had there. And for the rest of your life, you will say, "Yes, that's where I was supposed to go. That's what I had planned." And the pain of that will never, ever, ever, ever go away. Because the loss of that dream is a very, very significant loss. But if you spend your life mourning the fact that you didn't get to Italy, you may never be free to enjoy the very special, the very lovely things about Holland. Welcome to Holland made Julie furious. After all, there was nothing special or lovely about her cancer. But Dara, whose son had severe autism, said that Julie was missing the point. She agreed that Julie's prognosis was devastating and unfair and a complete departure from how her life was supposed to go. But she didn't want Julie to spend the time she had remaining, perhaps as long as 10 years, missing out on what she might still have while alive. Her marriage, her family, her work. She could still have a version of those things in Holland. To which Julie thought, "Screw you." And also, "You're right." Because Dara would know. I'd already heard about Dara from Julie, the same way I hear about all of my patients' close friends. I knew from Julie that when Dara was at her wit's end with worry and grief over her son's endless hitting and headbanging, his tantrums, his inability to have a conversation or feed himself at 4 years old, his need for multiple weekly therapies that had taken over her life, but also didn't seem to be helping, Dara would call Julie despondent. "Now, I'm embarrassed by this," Julie said, after she explained her initial anger toward Dara. "But when I saw what Dara was going through with her son, my biggest fear was to end up in her situation. I love her so much, and I also felt like any hope for the life she wanted had died." "Like you feel now," I said. Julie nodded. She told me that for a long while, Dara would say, "I didn't sign up for this," and catalog all the ways in which her life had been irrevocably changed. She and her husband would never have cuddles and carpools and reading stories before bed. They would never have a child who would grow into an independent adult. Dara would look at her husband, Julie said, and think, "He's an amazing father to our son." But she couldn't help contemplate the amazing father he could have been to a child who could fully interact with him. She couldn't help the sadness that would descend when she let herself think about the kinds of experiences they wouldn't be able to have with their child, ever. Dara felt selfish and guilty for her sadness, because she wished most of all that her son's life could be easier for his sake, that he could live a fulfilling life, one with friends and lovers and work. She felt enveloped by both pain and envy when she saw other moms playing with their four-year-olds at the park, knowing that in that situation, her son would likely lose control and be asked to leave, that her son would continue to be shunned as he grew older, and so would she. The look she got from the other moms, the ones who had typical kids with typical problems, added to her sense of isolation. Dara phoned Julie often that year, each call more hopeless than the previous one. Depleted financially, emotionally, and practically, she and her husband decided not to add a sibling to the mix. How could they afford and have time for another? And what if that child also had autism? She'd already stopped working in order to manage their son's life, while her husband took on an extra job, and she didn't know how to cope. Until one day she came across Welcome to Holland and realized that she would have to not only cope in this strange land, but find joy there where she could. There were still pleasures to be had, if she could let them in. In Holland, Dara found friends who understood her family situation. She found ways to connect with her son, to enjoy him and love him for who he was, and not focus on who he wasn't. She found ways to stop obsessing about what she did and did not know about tuna and soy and chemicals and cosmetics during her pregnancy that might have harmed her developing baby. She got care for her son so that she could care for herself and do meaningful part-time work and have meaningful downtime too. She and her husband found each other and their marriage again, while also struggling with the challenges they couldn't change. Instead of sitting in their hotel room the whole trip, they decided to venture out and see the country. Now Dara was inviting Julie to do the same, to look at the tulips and Rembrandts. And after Julie's anger about Welcome to Holland subsided, it occurred to her that there would always be somebody whose life seemed, more or less, enviable. Would Julie trade places with Dara now? Her first instinct, yes, in a heartbeat. Her second? Maybe not. She'd come up with various scenarios. If she could have 10 great years with a healthy child, would she take that over a longer life? Is it more difficult to be sick yourself or to have a child who is? She felt horrible even having these thoughts, but she couldn't deny them either. Do you think I'm a bad person? She'd ask. And I'd assure her that everyone who comes to therapy worries that what they think or feel might not be normal or good. And yet it's our honesty with ourselves that helps us make sense of our lives with all of their nuances and complexity. Repress those thoughts, and you'll likely behave badly. Acknowledge them, and you'll grow. In this way, Julie started to see that we're all in Holland, because most people don't have lives that go exactly as planned. Even if you're lucky enough to be traveling to Italy, you might experience canceled flights and horrible weather, or your spouse might have a fatal heart attack in the shower 10 minutes after the two of you have glorious sex in a luxurious Rome hotel room during a trip to celebrate your anniversary, as happened to an acquaintance of mine. So, Julie was going to Holland. She didn't know how long her stay would be, but we were booking her trip for 10 years and would change the itinerary as needed. Meanwhile, we'd work together to figure out what she wanted to do there. Julie had just one stipulation. Will you promise to tell me if I'm doing something crazy? I mean, now that I'm going to die sooner than I ever imagined, I don't have to be so sensible, right? So if I'm going overboard and things get a little over the top, you'll tell me? I said I would. Julie had spent her entire life being conscientious and responsible, doing everything by the book. And I couldn't imagine what her version of over the top would look like. I figured, if anything, it would be the equivalent of the goody-goody student who went a little crazy by having one too many beers at a party. But I'd forgotten that people are often at their most interesting when they've got a proverbial gun to their head. Bucket list, Julie said in session as we tried to envision her Holland. It's such a funny term, isn't it? I had to agree. What do we want to do before we kick the bucket? Often people think about bucket lists when somebody close to them dies. That's what happened for Candy Chang, an artist who, in 2009, created a space on a public wall in New Orleans with the prompt, "Before I die, blank." Within days, the wall was completely filled. People wrote things like, "Before I die, I want to straddle the international dateline. Before I die, I want to sing for millions. Before I die, I want to be completely myself." Soon the idea spawned over 1,000 such walls all over the world. Before I die, I would like to have a relationship with my sister, be a great dad, go skydiving, make a difference in someone's life. I don't know if people follow through, but based on what I've seen in my office, a good number may have had momentary awakenings, done a little soul searching, added more to their lists, and then neglected to tick things off. People tend to dream without doing, death remaining theoretical. We think we make bucket lists to ward off regret, but really they help us to ward off death. After all, the longer our bucket lists are, the more time we imagine we have left to accomplish everything on them. Cutting the list down, however, makes a tiny dent in our denial systems, forcing us to acknowledge a sobering truth. Life has a 100% mortality rate. Every single one of us will die, and most of us have no idea how or when that will happen. In fact, as each second passes, we're all in the process of coming closer to our eventual deaths. As the saying goes, none of us will get out of here alive. I'll bet right now you're glad that I'm not your therapist. Who wants to think about this? How much easier is it to become death procrastinators? Many of us take for granted the people we love and the things we find meaningful, only to realize, when our deadline is announced, that we've been skating by on the project. Our lives. But now Julie needed to grieve all the things she'd have to leave off her list. Unlike older people, who grieve for what they'll be losing and leaving behind, Julie was grieving for what she would never have. All of the milestones and firsts that people in their 30s just assume will happen. Julie had, as she put it, a concrete deadline. Dead being the operative part of the word, she said. A deadline so unforgiving that most of what she'd expected would never come to pass. One day, Julie told me that she'd begun to notice how often in casual conversation, people talked about the future. I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to start exercising. We're going to take a vacation this year. In 3 years, I'll get that promotion. I'm saving to buy a house. We want to have a second baby in a couple of years. I'll go to my next reunion in 5 years. They plan. It was hard for Julie to plan a future, not knowing how much time there was. What do you do when the difference between a year and 10 is enormous? Then, something miraculous happened. Julie's experimental treatment seemed to be shrinking her tumors. In a matter of weeks, they were almost gone. Her doctors were optimistic. Maybe she had longer than they thought. Maybe these drugs would work not just now or for a few years, but for the long term. There were a lot of maybes. So many maybes that when the tumors disappeared completely, she and Matt began, very tentatively, to become the kind of people who plan. When Julie examined her bucket list, she and Matt talked about having a baby. Should they have their own child if Julie might not be around for middle school? Or, if things went very badly, preschool? Was Matt up for that? What about the child? Was it fair for Julie to become a mother under these circumstances? Or would Julie's greatest motherly act be the decision not to become one, even if it would be the hardest sacrifice she'd ever make? Julie and Matt decided that they had to live their lives, even in the face of such uncertainty. If they had learned anything, it was that life is the very definition of uncertainty. What if Julie remained cautious, and they didn't have a baby because they were waiting for the cancer to return? But it never did. Matt assured Julie that he would be a committed father no matter what happened with Julie's health. He would always be there for their child. So it was decided. Looking death in the eye would force them to live more fully, not in the future with some long list of goals, but right now. Julie kept her bucket list lean. They were going to start their family. It didn't matter if they ended up in Italy or Holland or someplace else entirely. They would hop on a plane and see where they landed. Chapter 13. How Kids Deal with Grief. Shortly after the breakup, I told Zach, my 8-year-old, the news. We were eating dinner, and I tried to keep it simple. Boyfriend and I had both decided, poetic license, that we weren't going to be together after all. His face fell. He looked both surprised and confused. Welcome to the club, I thought. Why? He asked. I told him that before two people got married, they needed to figure out if they'd make good partners, not just for the moment, but for the rest of their lives. And even though boyfriend and I loved each other, both of us realized, again, poetic license, that we wouldn't, and that it was better for us to find other people who would. This was basically the truth, minus some details and plus a few pronoun changes. Why? Zach asked again. Why wouldn't you be good partners? His face was a wrinkle. My heart ached for him. Well, I said, you know how you used to hang out with Asher, and then he got really into soccer and you got really into basketball? He nodded. You guys still like each other, but now you spend more time with people who have similar interests. So you like different things. Yeah, I said. I like kids and he's a kid hater. What things? I took a breath. Well, things like I want to be home more and he wants to travel more. Kids and freedom are mutually exclusive, if the queen had balls. Why can't you both compromise? Why can't sometimes you stay home and sometimes you go traveling? I mulled this over. Maybe we could. But it's like that time you were assigned to work with Sonia on that poster, and she wanted to put pink butterflies all over it, and you wanted it to have clone troopers, and in the end you ended up with yellow dragons, which was pretty cool, but not really what either of you wanted. Then, on the next project, you worked with Theo, and even though you had different ideas, they were similar enough, and you still both compromised, but not as much as you had to do with Sonia. He was staring at the table. Everyone has to compromise to get along, I said. But if you have to compromise too much, it might be hard to be married to each other. If one of us wanted to travel a lot and one of us wanted to stay home a lot, we both might get frustrated a lot. Does that make sense? Yeah, he said. We sat together for a minute, and then suddenly he looked up and blurted out, are we killing a banana if we eat it? What? I said, thrown by the non sequitur. You know how you kill a cow to get the meat, and that's why vegetarians don't eat meat? Uh-huh. Well, he continued, if we pull the banana off the tree, aren't we also killing the banana? I guess it's like hair, I said. Hair falls off our heads when it's ready to die, and then new hair grows in its place. New bananas grow where the old ones used to be. Zach leaned forward in his chair. But we pull the bananas before they fall off, when they're still alive. What if somebody pulled your hair out before it was ready to fall off? So doesn't it kill the banana? And doesn't it hurt the tree when we pull the banana off? Oh. This was Zach's way of dealing with the news. He was the tree here, or the banana. Either way, he was hurting. I don't know, I said. Maybe we don't intend to hurt the tree or the banana, but it's possible that sometimes we hurt it anyway, even though we really, really don't want to. He went quiet for a while. Then, am I going to see him again? I told him I didn't think so. So we're not going to play Goblet anymore? Goblet was a board game that belonged to boyfriend's kids when they were young, and Zach and boyfriend sometimes played it together. I told him no, not with boyfriend. But if he felt like it, I'd play it with him. Maybe, he said quietly. But he was really good at it. He was really good at it, I agreed. I know this is a big change, I added. And then I stopped talking, because nothing I said would help him right then. He was going to have to feel sad. I knew that over the next few days and weeks and even months, we'd have many conversations to help him through this. The upside of being a therapist's child is that nothing gets shoved under the rug. The downside is that you'll be totally screwed up anyway. Meanwhile, the news would have to marinate. Okay, Zach mumbled. Then he got up from the table, went over to the fruit bowl on the counter, picked up a banana, ripped it open, and with dramatic flair, sunk his teeth into it. Yum, he said, a strangely gleeful look on his face. Was he murdering the banana? He devoured the entire thing in 3 bites and then went to his room. 5 minutes later, he came out carrying the goblet game. Let's give this to Goodwill, he said, placing the box by the door. Then he walked over to me for a hug. I don't like it anymore anyway. Chapter 14. Harold and Maud. At medical school, my cadaver's name was Harold. Or, rather, that's what my lab partners and I named him, after the group next to us named theirs Maud. We were in gross anatomy, the traditional first-year human dissection course, and each student team at Stanford worked on the cadaver of a generous person who had donated his or her body to science. Our professors gave us 2 instructions before we stepped foot in the lab. 1. pretend that the bodies belonged to our grandmothers, and show respect accordingly. Do normal people slice up their grandmothers? One freaked-out student replied. 2. Pay attention to any emotions that came up during what we were told would be an intense process. We weren't given any information about our cadavers. Names, ages, medical histories, causes of death. The names were withheld for privacy, and the rest because the goal was to solve a mystery. Not a whodunit, but a whydunit. Why did this person die? Was he a smoker, a red meat lover, a diabetic? Over the semester, I discovered that Harold had had a hip replacement. Clue, the metal staples in his side. His mitral valve had been leaky. Clue, enlargement on the left side of the heart. He'd been constipated, probably from lying in a hospital bed, at the end of his life. Clue, the backed up feces in his colon. He had pale blue eyes, straight, yellowing teeth, a circle of white hair, and the muscular fingers of a builder, pianist, or surgeon. Later, I learned that he'd died of pneumonia at 92, which surprised us all, including our professor who declared he had the organs of a 60-year-old. Maud, however, had lungs full of tumors, and her nicely painted pink nails belied the nicotine stains on her fingers from her habit. She was the opposite of Harold. Her body had aged prematurely, making her organs seem like those of someone much older. One day, the Maud Squad, as we called Maud's lab group, carved out her heart. One of the students lifted it gingerly and held it up for the others to examine, but it slipped off her glove, fell to the floor with a thud, and split apart. We all gasped. A broken heart. How easy it is, I thought, to break someone's heart, even when you take great care not to. Pay attention to your emotions, we'd been instructed. But it was far more convenient to close them off as we scalped our cadaver and sawed open his skull like a cantaloupe. It's another Black and Decker day, our professor said when he greeted us on the second morning of that unit. A week later, we'd do a gentle dissection of the ear, meaning chisels and hammers, but no saws. We opened each lab session by unzipping the bag containing our cadaver and pausing as a class for a minute of silence to honor the people who were letting us take their bodies apart. We started below the neck, keeping their heads covered as a sign of respect. And when we moved up to their faces, we kept their eyelids closed, again out of respect, but also to make them seem less human to us, less real. Dissection showed us that living is a precarious thing, and we did our best to distance ourselves from this fact by lightening the mood with obscene mnemonics passed down from class to class, like the one for the cranial nerves, olfactory, optic, oculomotor, trochlear, trigeminal, abducens, facial, vestibulocochlear, glossopharyngeal, vagus, accessory, and hypoglossal. Oh, 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 to touch and feel Virginia's greasy vagina, ah. While dissecting the head and neck, the class would shout this out in unison. Then we'd hit the books and prepare for the next day's lab. Our hard work paid off. We aced each unit. But I'm not sure that any of us were paying attention to our emotions. When exams rolled around, we did our first walkabout. A walkabout is just that. You walk about a room full of skin and bone and viscera as if examining the wreckage from a horrific plane crash. Except, your job is to identify not the victims, but the individual parts. Instead of, I think this is John Smith, you try to figure out if the fleshy thing sitting by itself on a table is part of a hand or a foot, then say, I think this is extensor carpi radialis longus. But even that wasn't the goriest experience we had. The day we dissected Harold's penis. Cold, leathery, lifeless. The students at Maud's table, having a cadaver with female organs, joined us to observe. Kate, my lab partner, was meticulous in her dissections. Her focus, the professor liked to say, was as sharp as a nine blade. But now she was distracted by shouts from the Maud squad, watching her work. The deeper she sliced, the louder the shouts became. Ouch! Ew! I think I'm gonna puke! More classmates came over to watch, and a bunch of male students started dancing in circles and guarding their crotches with their plastic-protected textbooks. Drama queens, Kate muttered. She had no patience for squeamishness. She was going to be a surgeon. Refocusing, Kate used a probe to locate the spermatic cord, then grabbed the scalpel again and made a vertical incision along the entire base of the penis so that it split open into two halves like a hot dog.
Okay, that's it. I'm out of here,
one of the guys announced, and then he and several of his friends ran from the room. The final day of the course, there was a ceremony in which we paid our respects to the people who had let us learn from their bodies. We all read personal thank you notes to them, played music, and offered blessings, hoping that even though their bodies had been dismantled, their souls were intact and open to receiving our gratitude. We talked a lot about the vulnerability of our cadavers, exposed and at our mercy, cut open and scrutinized millimeter by millimeter, samples of them literally put under a microscope as we removed their tissues. But we were the truly vulnerable ones, made more so by our unwillingness to admit it. We were first years wondering if we could hack it in this field, young people seeing death up close, students not knowing what to make of the tears we'd sometimes shed at the most unexpected moments. They had told us to pay attention to our emotions, but we weren't sure what our emotions were, or what to do with them anyway. Some people took meditation classes offered by the medical school. Some thrived on exercise. Others buried themselves in their studies. One student on the mod squad took up smoking, sneaking out for quick cigarette breaks and refusing to believe he'd end up tumor-ridden like his cadaver. I volunteered for a literacy program and read to kindergartners. How healthy they were, how alive, how intact their body parts. And when I wasn't doing that, I wrote. I wrote about my experiences, and I became curious about other people's experiences. And then I started writing about these experiences for magazines and newspapers. At one point, I wrote about a class called Doctor Patient that taught us how to interact with the people we would one day treat. As part of our final exam, each student was videotaped taking a medical history, and my professor commented that I was the only student who'd asked the patient how she was feeling. That should be your first question, he told the class. Stanford emphasized the need to treat patients as people, not cases. But at the same time, our professors would say, this was becoming harder to do because of the way the practice of medicine was changing. Gone were the long-term personal relationships and meaningful encounters, replaced by some newfangled system called managed care, with its 15-minute visits, factory-like treatment, and restrictions on what a doctor could do for each patient. As I moved on from gross anatomy, I thought a lot about what specialty I might choose. Was there one in which the older model of the family doctor survived? Or would I not know the names of many of my patients, much less anything about their lives? I shadowed doctors in various specialties, ruling out the ones with the least amount of patient interaction. Emergency medicine. Exciting, but you rarely see your patients again. Radiology. You see pictures, not people. Anesthesiology. Your patients are asleep. Surgery. Ditto. I liked internal medicine and pediatrics, but the physicians I followed warned me that those practices were becoming far less personal. To stay afloat, they had to cram in 30 patients each day. If they were starting out now, a few even said, they might consider another field. Why become a doctor if you can write? One professor asked after he had read something I'd written for a magazine. When I was at NBC, I worked with stories, but wanted real life. Now that I had real life, I wondered if, in the modern daily practice of medicine, there'd be no room for people's stories. What was satisfying, I discovered, was immersing myself in other people's lives. And the more I wrote as a journalist, the more I found myself doing just that. One day, I talked to a professor about my dilemma, and she suggested that I do both, journalism and medicine together. If I could bring in extra income as a writer, she said, I could have a smaller practice and see patients the way doctors used to. But, she added, I'd still have to answer to insurance companies with their time-consuming mounds of paperwork, which would take me away from patient care. Has it really come to this? I thought. Writing as a way to support a living as a doctor? Didn't it used to be the other way around? I considered her idea anyway. At that point, though, I was 33 years old, with 2 more years of medical school, at least 3 years of residency, maybe a fellowship after that. And I knew that I wanted a family. The more I saw the effects of managed care up close, the less I could imagine myself taking the years-long risk of finishing my training and then trying to find out if it was possible to concoct the kind of practice I wanted while also being a writer. Besides, I wasn't sure I could do both. Not well, at least, and also have room for a personal life. By the end of the term, I felt like I had to choose: journalism or medicine. I chose journalism. And over the next several years, I published books and wrote hundreds of magazine and newspaper stories. Finally, I thought, I found my professional calling. As for the rest of my life, the family, that too would fall into place. At the time I left medical school, I was absolutely sure of it. Chapter 15. Hold the Mayo. Seriously? Is that all you shrinks care about? John is back on my couch, sitting cross-legged and barefoot. He's come in wearing flip-flops, because the pedicurist was at the studio today. His toenails, I notice, are as perfect as his teeth. I've just asked something about his childhood, and he's not happy about it. How many times do I have to tell you I had a great childhood? He continues. My parents were saints. Saints. Whenever I hear about saintly parents, I get suspicious. It's not that I'm looking for problems. It's just that no parent is a saint. Most of us end up being the good enough parents that Donald Winnicott, the influential English pediatrician and child psychiatrist, believed was sufficient to raise a well-adjusted child. Even so, the poet Philip Larkin put it best. They fuck you up, your mom and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. It wasn't until I became a parent that I could truly understand two crucial things about therapy. One, the purpose of inquiring about people's parents isn't to join them in blaming, judging, or criticizing their parents. In fact, it's not about their parents at all. It's solely about understanding how their early experiences inform who they are as adults, so that they can separate the past from the present and not wear psychological clothing that no longer fits. Two, most people's parents did their absolute best, whether that best was an A- or a D+. It's the rare parent who, however limited, deep down doesn't want his or her child to have a good life. That doesn't mean people can't have feelings about their parents' limitations or mental health challenges. They just need to figure out what to do with them. Here's what I know about John so far. He's 40 years old, married for 12 years, and has two daughters, ages 10 and 4, and a dog. He writes and produces popular television shows. And when I learn which ones, I'm not surprised. He's won Emmys precisely because his characters are so brilliantly wicked and insensitive. He complains that his wife is depressed, although, as the saying goes, before diagnosing people with depression, make sure they're not surrounded by assholes. His kids don't respect him, his colleagues waste his time, and everyone demands too much of him. His father and two older siblings live in the Midwest, where John grew up. He was the only one to move away. His mother died when he was 6, and his brothers were 12 and 14. She was a drama teacher, and she had been leaving the high school after rehearsal when she saw one of her students in the path of a speeding car. She ran and pushed the student out of the way, but she was hit herself and died at the scene. John told me this part with no emotion, as if he were matter-of-factly recounting the plot of one of his TV shows. His father, an English professor with aspirations to be a writer, took care of the boys alone until he married a widowed neighbor with no children 3 years later. John described his stepmom as vanilla, but I have nothing against her. While John has had a lot to say about the various idiots in his life, his parents have been largely absent from our conversations. During my internship, a supervisor suggested that with very defended patients, one way to get a sense of their pasts is by asking them, without thinking about it, what three adjectives come immediately to mind in relation to your mom's or dad's personality? These off-the-cuff answers have always given me, and my patients, helpful insights into their parental relationships. But nothing comes of this with John. Saint, saint, and saint. That's three words for both of them, he replies, using nouns instead of adjectives despite his writerly facility with words. I'll learn later that his father might have had a drinking problem after his wife died, and possibly still does, and that John's oldest brother once told John that their mother might have had a light version of bipolar disorder, but John said his brother was just being dramatic. I'm curious about John's childhood because of his narcissism. His self-involvement, defensiveness, demeaning treatment of others, need to dominate the conversation, and sense of entitlement, basically his being an asshole, all fall under the diagnostic criteria for narcissistic personality disorder. I noticed these traits at our very first session, and while some therapists might have referred John out, narcissistic personalities aren't considered good candidates for introspective, insight-oriented therapy due to their struggle to see themselves and others clearly. I was game. I didn't want to lose the person behind the diagnosis. Yes, John had likened me to a prostitute, acted as though he were the only person in the room, and felt that he was better than everyone else. But underneath all that, how different, really, was he from the rest of us? The term personality disorder evokes all kinds of associations, not just for therapists, who consider these patients to be a handful, but in the popular culture as well. There's even a Wikipedia entry that catalogs movie characters and the personality disorders they exemplify. The most recent version of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the clinical Bible of psychological conditions, lists 10 types of personality disorders, broken into three groups, called clusters. Cluster A, odd, bizarre, eccentric. Paranoid PD, schizoid PD, schizotypal PD. Cluster B, dramatic, erratic. Antisocial PD, borderline PD, histrionic PD, narcissistic PD. Cluster C, anxious, fearful. Avoidant PD, dependent PD, obsessive-compulsive PD. In outpatient practice, we mostly see patients in Cluster B. People who are untrusting, paranoid, loners, schizoid, or oddballs, schizotypal, don't tend to seek out therapy. So there goes Cluster A. People who shun connection, avoidant, struggle to function like adults, dependent, or are rigid workaholics, obsessive-compulsive, also don't look for help very often. So there goes Cluster C. The antisocial folks in Cluster B generally won't be calling us either. But the people who experience difficulty in relationships and are either extremely emotional, histrionics and borderlines, or married to people like this, narcissists, do make their way to us. Borderline types tend to couple up with narcissists, and we see that pairing often in couples therapy. Until very recently, most mental health practitioners believed that personality disorders were incurable, because unlike mood disorders, such as depression and anxiety, personality disorders consist of long-standing, pervasive patterns of behavior that are very much a part of one's personality. In other words, personality disorders are egosyntonic, which means the behaviors seem in sync with the person's self-concept. As a result, people with these disorders believe that others are creating the problems in their lives. Mood disorders, on the other hand, are ego dystonic, which means the people suffering from them find them distressing. They don't like being depressed or anxious or needing to flick the lights on and off 10 times before leaving the house. They know something's off with them. But personality disorders lie on a spectrum. People with borderline personality disorder are terrified of abandonment. But for some, that might mean feeling anxious when their partners don't respond to texts right away. For others, that might mean choosing to stay in volatile, dysfunctional relationships rather than being alone. Or consider the narcissist. Who doesn't know somebody who fits the bill to varying degrees? Accomplished, charismatic, smart, and witty, but alarmingly egocentric. Most important, having traits of a personality disorder doesn't necessarily mean that a person meets the criteria for an official diagnosis. From time to time, On a doozy of a bad day, or when pushed until a fragile nerve is struck, everyone exhibits a tad of this or that personality disorder, because each is rooted in the very human wish for self-preservation, acceptance, and safety. If you don't think this applies to you, just ask your spouse or best friend. In other words, just as I always try to see the whole person and not just the snapshot, I also try to see the underlying struggle and not just the 5-digit diagnosis code I can put on an insurance form. If I rely on that code too much, I start to see every aspect of the treatment through this lens, which interferes with forming a real relationship with the unique individual sitting in front of me. John may be a narcissist, but he's also just John, who can be arrogant and, to use a non-clinical description, incredibly fucking annoying. And yet, diagnosis has its usefulness. I know, for example, that people who are demanding, critical, and angry tend to suffer from intense loneliness. I know that a person who acts this way both wants to be seen and is terrified of being seen. I believe that for John, the experience of being vulnerable feels pathetic and shameful, and I'm guessing that he somehow got the message not to show weakness at 6 years old when his mother died. If he spends any time at all with his emotions, they likely overwhelm him, so he projects them onto others as anger, derision, or criticism. That's why patients like John are especially challenging. They're masters at getting your goat, all in the service of deflection. My job is to help both of us understand what feelings he's hiding from. He's got fortresses and moats to keep me out. But I know that part of him is in the turret calling for help, hoping to be saved. From what? I don't know yet. And I'll apply my knowledge of diagnosis, without getting lost in it, to help John see that the way he acts in the world might be causing more problems for him than the so-called idiots around him are. Your light is on. John and I are discussing his irritation with my questions about his childhood when he announces that the green light on the wall near my door that's connected to a button in the waiting room is illuminated. I glance at the light, then at the clock. It's just 5 minutes past the hour, so I figure that my next patient must be uncharacteristically early. It is, I say, wondering if John is trying to change the subject or if he might even have some feelings about the fact that he's not my only patient. Many patients secretly wish to be their therapist's only patient, or at least the favorite, the funniest, most entertaining, and above all, most beloved. "Can you get it?" John says, nodding toward the light. "It's my lunch." I'm confused. "Your lunch?" "The food delivery guy is out there. You said no cell phone, so I told him to press the button. I haven't had time for lunch yet, and now I have a free hour. I mean, 50 minutes. I need to eat." I'm floored. People don't generally eat in therapy, but if they do, they'll say something along the lines of, "Is it okay if I eat in here today?" And they bring their own food. Even my patient with hypoglycemia brought food into this room only once, and that was to avoid going into shock. "Don't worry," John says, registering the look on my face. "You can have some if you want." Then he gets up, walks down the hall, and retrieves his lunch from the delivery person in the waiting room. When John comes back, he unpacks the bag, puts a napkin on his lap, unwraps his sandwich, takes a bite, then loses it. "Jesus Christ, I said no mayo! Look at this!" He opens up the sandwich to show me the mayonnaise, and with his free hand, he reaches for his cell phone, presumably to call about his order. But I give him a look, reminding him of the no cell phone policy. His face turns bright red, and I wonder if he might yell at me too. But instead, he just explodes with, "Idiot!" "Me?" I ask. "You what?" "I remember you once described your last therapist as nice, but an idiot. Am I also nice, but an idiot?" "No, not at all," he says. And I'm pleased that he's able to acknowledge that somebody in his life isn't an idiot. "Thank you," I say. "For what?" "For saying I'm not an idiot." "That's not what I meant," he replies. "I meant no, you're not nice. You won't let me use my phone to call the idiot who put mayonnaise on my sandwich. So I'm mean and an idiot. He grins, and when he does, his eyes twinkle and his dimples appear. For a second, I can see how some people might find him charming. Well, you're mean, that's for sure. I don't know about the idiot part yet. He's being playful, and I smile back. Phew, I say. At least you're giving me the benefit of getting to know me first. I appreciate that. He begins fidgeting, uncomfortable with my attempt to engage. He's so desperate to escape from this moment of human contact that he starts munching on his mayonnaise-y sandwich and looks away. But he's not fighting me, and I'll take it. I sense a microscopic opening. I'm sorry that you experience me as being mean, I say. Is that why you made that comment about the 50 minutes? The mistress insult, that I'm more like his hooker, was more complicated. But I'm guessing he made the 50 minutes crack for the same reason most people do. They wish they could stay longer, but don't know how to say this directly. Acknowledging their attachment makes them feel too vulnerable. No, I'm glad it's 50 minutes, he says. God knows, if I stayed for an hour, you'd keep asking me about my childhood. I just want to get to know you better, I say. What's to know? I'm anxious and I can't sleep. I'm juggling 3 shows, my wife's complaining all the time, my 10-year-old is acting like a teenager, my 4-year-old misses the nanny who left for graduate school, the fucking dog is acting out, and I'm surrounded by idiots who make my life harder than it needs to be. And frankly, I'm pissed off at this point. That's a lot, I say. You're dealing with a lot. John says nothing. He's chewing his food and studying a spot on the floor near his flip-flops. Damn right, he says finally. What's so hard to understand about 3 words? Hold the mayo. That's it. You know, about those idiots, I say. I have a thought about that. What if the people who are pissing you off aren't trying to piss you off? What if these people aren't idiots, but reasonably intelligent people who are just doing the best they can on a given day? John lifts his eyes slightly, as if considering this. And, I add softly, thinking that as hard as he is on others, he's probably triply hard on himself. What if you are too? John starts to say something, then stops. He looks back toward his flip-flops, lifts a napkin, and pretends to wipe the crumbs from his mouth. But I see it happen anyway. He quickly maneuvers the napkin upward and below his eye. Goddamn sandwich, he says, stuffing the napkin into the food bag along with the rest of the meal, before tossing the whole thing into the trash can under my desk. Swish, a perfect shot. He looks at the clock. This is nuts, you know. I'm starving. It's my one break to eat, and I can't even use my phone to order a proper lunch. You call this therapy? I want to say, yes, this is therapy. Face to face, without phones or sandwiches, so that 2 people can sit together and connect. But I know John will just offer a sardonic rebuttal. I think about what Margot must go through, and wonder what her own psychological history must be for her to have chosen John. I'll make you a deal, John says. I'll tell you something about my childhood, if I can order some lunch from the place up the street. I'll order for both of us. Let's just be civilized and have a conversation over a goddamn Chinese chicken salad, okay? He looks at me, waiting. Normally, I wouldn't do this. But therapy isn't by the numbers. We need professional boundaries, but if they're too open, like an ocean, or too constricting, like a fishbowl, we run into trouble. An aquarium seems just right. We need space for spontaneity, which is why when Wendell kicked me, it was effective. And if John needs some distance between us in the form of food to feel comfortable talking to me right now, so be it. I tell him we can order lunch, but he doesn't have to talk about his childhood. It's not a quid pro quo. He ignores me and dials a restaurant to place the order, a process that, of course, frustrates him. Right, no dressing. Not drinks, dressing. He's yelling into the phone, which is on speaker. D-R-E-S-S-I-N-G. He sighs loudly, rolls his eyes. Extra dressing? The guy at the restaurant says in broken English. and John becomes apoplectic as he tries to communicate that the dressing should be on the side. Everything's a problem. They have Diet Pepsi, not Diet Coke. They can be here in 20 minutes, not 15. I watch, horrified and bemused. It must be so hard to be John, I think. As they wrap up, John says something in Chinese, and the guy doesn't understand. John doesn't understand why the guy doesn't understand his own language, and the guy explains that he speaks Cantonese. They hang up, and John looks at me, incredulous. What? They don't use Mandarin? If you know Chinese, why didn't you use it to place the order? I ask. John gives me a withering look. Because I speak English. Yikes. John grumbles until lunch arrives. But once we set out our salads, he lets down the drawbridge a bit. I've already had lunch, but I eat some salad anyway to join him. There's something innately bonding about sharing a meal together. I hear some stories about his father and older brothers, and how he thinks it's strange that while he doesn't remember much about his mom, he began dreaming about her a few years ago. He keeps having versions of the same dream, like Groundhog Day, and he can't make it stop. He wants it to stop. Even in his sleep, he says, he's being bothered. He just wants peace. I inquire about the dream, but he says it will upset him to talk about it, and he's not paying me to upset him. Didn't he just tell me that he wanted peace? Don't they teach listening skills to therapists? I want to talk about what he just said, to challenge his beliefs that he shouldn't be uncomfortable in therapy, and that he can find peace without also experiencing discomfort. But I need time for that, and there are just a couple of minutes left. I ask when he has peace. Walking the dog, he says. Until Rosie started acting out, that used to be peaceful. I think about how he doesn't want to bring the dream into this room. Could it be that this room has become something of a sanctuary for him? Away from his job, wife, kids, dog, the world's idiots, and the ghost of his mom that appears in his sleep? Hey, John, I try. Are you feeling peaceful right now? He chucks his chopsticks into the bag where he'd just packed away the remains of his salad. Of course not, he says, adding an impatient eye roll. Oh, I say, letting it go. But John hasn't. Our time is up and he stands to leave. Are you kidding? He continues as he heads to the door. In here? Peace? His eye roll has been replaced by a smile now. Not a condescending smirk, but a secret he's sharing with me. It's a lovely smile, luminous, and not because of those dazzling teeth. I thought so, I say. Chapter 16. The Whole Package. Spoiler, after I left medical school, the rest of my life did not fall into place as planned. 3 years later, when I was nearly 37, a two-year relationship ended. It was sad but amicable, and not a surprise the way the breakup with boyfriend later turned out to be. But still, it was the worst timing imaginable for someone who wanted to have a baby. I'd always known, in the surest possible way, that I wanted to be a parent. I'd spent my adulthood volunteering with kids and assumed that I would one day have my own. Now, though, with 40 looming, I was dying to have a baby. But not so much that I would just marry the next guy who came along. This left me in a tricky predicament. Desperate, but picky. It was then that a friend suggested I could do things in reverse order. Baby first, partner later. One night, she emailed me links for some sperm donor sites. I'd never heard of such a thing and wasn't sure at first how I felt about it. But after considering my options, I made the decision to move forward. Now I just needed to choose a donor. Of course, I wanted a donor with a good health history. But on these sites, there were other qualities to consider. And not just things like hair color or height. Did I want a lacrosse player or a literature major? A Truffaut buff or a trombonist? An extrovert or an introvert? I was surprised to see that in many ways, these donor profiles resembled dating profiles. Except that most of the candidates were college students and provided their SAT scores. And there were a few other key differences, chief among them the comments of the so-called lab girls. These were the women, they all seemed to be female, who worked at the banks and met the donors when they came in to give a release, not in the sense of contract. The lab girls would then write what they termed staff impressions and add them to the donors' profiles. But there was no rhyme or reason as to what kinds of impressions they'd share. Their comments varied wildly from, "He has amazing biceps," to, "He tends to procrastinate, but eventually gets his stuff done." I was wary of any male college student whose procrastination extended to masturbation. I relied heavily on these staff impressions, because the more profiles I read, the more I realized that I wanted to feel some intangible connection to the donor who would have a connection to my child. I wanted to like him, whatever that meant, to feel that if he were sitting at our family dinner table, I would enjoy his company. But as I read the staff impressions and listened to the audio of the interviews that the lab girls conducted with the donors, "What's the funniest thing that's ever happened to you? How would you describe your personality?" And weirdly, "What's your idea of a romantic first date?" It still felt clinical, impersonal. Then one day, I called up the sperm bank with a question about a donor's health history and was transferred to a lab girl named Kathleen. As Kathleen looked up his medical records, I began chatting with her and learned that she had been the lab girl who'd met this particular donor. I couldn't help myself. "Is he cute?" I asked, trying to sound casual. I didn't know if I was allowed to be asking. "Well," Kathleen hedged, drawing out the word in her thick New York accent. "He's not unattractive, but I wouldn't look twice at him on the subway." After that, Kathleen became my sperm concierge, suggesting donors and answering my questions. I trusted her because while some of the lab girls inflated their assessments, they were trying to sell sperm after all, Kathleen was honest to a fault. Her standards were very high, and so were mine, which was a problem because nobody made it through our filters. To be fair, it seemed reasonable to assume that my future child would want me to be picky, and there were multiple factors to juggle. If I found a donor who seemed to share my sensibilities, there would be other problems, like his family's health history wasn't a good match with mine. Breast cancer under age 60, kidney disease. Or I'd find a donor with pristine health history, but who was a 6'4" Danish guy with Nordic features, a look that would stick out. And might make my child feel self-conscious in my family of short, brown-haired Ashkenazi Jews. Other donors seemed to have good health, intelligence, and similar physical features, but something else would raise a red flag. Like the donor who wrote that his favorite color was black, his favorite book, Lolita, and his favorite movie, A Clockwork Orange. I tried to imagine my child reading this profile one day and looking at me like, "And you chose this one?" I had the same reaction if the donor couldn't spell or use punctuation correctly. This process continued for 3 exhausting months, during which I began to lose hope that I'd find a healthy donor I'd be proud to tell my child about. And then, finally, I found him. I came home late one evening to a message on my voicemail from Kathleen. She told me to check out a donor she described as looking like a young George Clooney. She added that she especially liked this donor because he was always friendly and in a great mood when he arrived at the bank to donate. I rolled my eyes. After all, if you're a guy in his 20s who's about to go watch porn and have an orgasm, and you're getting paid for that, what's not to be in a great mood about? But Kathleen gushed about this guy. He had good health, good looks, strong intelligence, and a winning personality. "He's the whole package," she said confidently. Kathleen had never sounded so enthusiastic, so I logged on to take a look. I clicked on his profile, pored over his health history, read his essays, listened to his audio interview, and instantly knew, in the same way that people talk about love at first sight, that I'd found the one. Everything about him, his likes and dislikes, his sense of humor, his interests and values, felt like family. Elated but exhausted, I figured I'd get some sleep and handle the details in the morning. The next day happened to be my birthday, and overnight I had vivid dreams about my baby for what felt like 8 hours straight. For the first time, I pictured an actual baby coming from two specific people, instead of some hazy idea of a baby with half its heritage blank. In the morning, I jumped out of bed with a burst of excitement, the song Child of Mine playing in my head. Happy birthday to me! I'd been wanting a baby for the past several years, and finding a donor I felt so comfortable with seemed like the best birthday present ever. Heading to the computer, I smiled at my good fortune. I was really going to do this. I typed in the sperm bank's URL, found the donor's profile, and read it all over again. I was just as certain as I'd been the night before that he was the one. The one that would make sense to my child when he or she asked why, of all the possible donors, I chose this guy. I placed the donor in my online shopping cart, just as I might with a book on Amazon, double-checked the order, then clicked Purchase Vials. I'm having a baby, I thought. The moment felt monumental. As the order processed, I planned what I had to do next. Make an appointment for the insemination, buy prenatal vitamins, put together a baby registry, get the baby's room set up. Between thoughts, I noticed that my order was taking a while to complete. The rotating circle on my screen, known as the spinning wheel of death, seemed to be spinning for an unusually long time. I waited some more, and finally tried using the back button in case my computer was crashing. But nothing happened. Finally, the spinning wheel of death disappeared, and a message popped up. Out of stock. Out of stock? I figured there must be some computer glitch. Maybe when I pressed the back button? So I speed dialed the sperm bank and asked for Kathleen. But she was out, and I got transferred to a customer service rep named Barb. Barb looked into the matter and determined that this was no glitch. I'd selected a very popular donor, she said. She went on to explain that popular donors went quickly, and that while the company tried to restock their inventory often, there was a 6-month hold for it so it could get quarantined and tested. Even when the inventory was made available, she said, there still might be a long wait because some people had placed it on back order. As Barb spoke, I thought of how Kathleen had called just yesterday. Now it occurred to me that maybe she'd suggested this donor to several women. Like me, maybe many women had bonded with Kathleen over her honest appraisals of semen. Barb placed me on the wait list. Don't be foolish and waste your time waiting, she'd said ominously. Then I put down the phone and felt numb. After months of fruitless searching, I'd found my donor, and my future baby had finally seemed like a reality, more than just an idea in my head. But now, on my birthday, I had to let that baby go. I was all the way back at square one. I slumped over my laptop, staring into space. I sat there for a long while, until I noticed, on the corner of my desk, a business card that I'd gotten the week before at a professional networking event. It was from a 27-year-old filmmaker named Alex. I'd spoken to Alex for only about 5 minutes, but he was kind and smart and seemed healthy. And I thought, with the impulsivity of somebody running out of options, that maybe I could skip the online banks and try to find my donor out in the real world. Alex fit the profile of the kind of donor I sought. Why not ask if he'd consider it? After all, the worst he could say was no. I chose my subject line carefully. An unusual question, and left the email vague. Hey, remember me from that networking event? Then I invited him to meet for coffee so that I could ask my unusual question. Alex responded, wondering if I could email him the question. I replied that I'd prefer to discuss it in person. He wrote, sure. And the next thing I knew, we were set to meet for coffee Sunday at noon. I was, to put it mildly, nervous when I arrived at Earth Cafe. After sending my impulsive email, I was certain that Alex would say no and then tell 10 of his friends what I'd done, leaving me so humiliated that I'd never be able to go to a networking event again. I'd considered backing out, but I wanted a baby so badly that I felt I had to do this, just in case. The answer to an unasked question is always no, I repeated to myself over and over. Alex greeted me warmly, and the small talk came easily. So easily that, before I knew it, we were having a great time. After about an hour, in fact, I'd almost forgotten what we were doing there, when Alex leaned across the table, looked me in the eye, and asked flirtatiously, as if he'd concluded we were on a date. So, what was your unusual question? Instantly, my face felt hot and my palms sweaty. And I did what any normal person would do under the circumstances. I went mute. The gravity and lunacy of what I was about to do rendered me speechless. Alex waited until I began forming words, flailing, using incoherent analogies to explain my request. I was saying things like, I don't have all the ingredients for the recipe, and it's like donating a kidney, but without removing the organ. The second I said the word organ, I got even more flustered and tried changing course. It's like giving blood, I said, except there's sex instead of needles. With that, I willed myself to shut up. Alex was staring back with a strange look on his face, and I thought, life does not get more humiliating than this. But then it did, because it quickly became apparent that Alex had no idea what I was trying to ask. Look, I managed to say, I'm 37 years old, and I want to have a baby. I'm not having luck with the sperm banks, and I'm wondering if you'd consider. This time, Alex clearly got it, because his entire body froze. Even his mocha chai latte stayed suspended in midair. Other than one catatonic patient in medical school, I'd never seen a person sit so still before in my life. Finally, Alex's lips moved, and out came one word. Wow. Then, slowly, more words came out. I wasn't expecting that at all. I know, I said. I felt terrible for having put him in such an awkward situation, for bringing this up at all, and I was just about to say so, when, to my amazement, Alex added, but I'd be willing to talk about it. Now it was my turn to freeze before eventually saying, wow. The next few hours flew by. Alex and I discussed about everything from our childhoods to future dreams. It seemed that talking about sperm had broken down all the emotional walls, the way having sex with somebody for the first time can open up the emotional floodgates. When we finally got up to leave, Alex said that he needed to do some thinking, and I said okay, and he said he'd be in touch. I was sure, though, that once he actually thought this through, I'd never hear from him again. But that night, Alex's name appeared in my inbox. I clicked on his message, expecting a nice rejection. Instead, he wrote, so far, I am a yes, but with more questions. So we set up another meeting. Over the next couple of months, we met at Earth so often that I started calling the cafe my sperm office, and my friends started calling it simply Spurth. At Spurth, we talked about everything from semen samples and medical histories to contracts and contact with the child. Eventually, we got to the point where we talked about how to do the transfer, whether we should have the doctor do the insemination or have sex to increase the odds of conception. He picked sex. Honestly, I had no objection. And more honestly, I was thrilled with this development. After all, I imagined that in my future life as a mom, there wouldn't be much opportunity to have sex with a gorgeous 27-year-old like Alex, with his ripped abs and chiseled cheekbones. Meanwhile, I began obsessively monitoring my menstrual cycles. One day at Spurth, I mentioned to Alex that I was about to ovulate. So, if we were going to try this month, he had exactly 1 week to make a decision. In other circumstances, that might have seemed like a lot of pressure to put on a guy. But by now, it felt like a done deal, and I didn't have time to waste. We'd already looked at our plan from every possible angle. Legal, emotional, ethical, practical. By this point, too, we had inside jokes and nicknames for each other, and had bonded over what a blessing this child would be. The week before, he had even asked if, like any other business opportunity, I had gone out to others, or if this was an exclusive offer. I had the fleeting impulse to invent a bidding war to seal the deal. Pete is circling, and there's also interest from Gary, so you better get back to me by Friday, There's a lot of heat around this. But I wanted our relationship to be based in complete truthfulness. And anyway, I was sure that Alex would say yes. The day after I issued the deadline, we decided to take a walk on the beach to discuss one last time the final details in the contract we'd drawn up. As we strolled along the shore, drizzle appeared out of nowhere. We looked at each other. Should we head back? But then the drizzle turned into a veritable storm. We were both in short sleeves, and Alex took the jacket from around his waist and placed it over my shoulders. And as we faced each other, getting drenched in the rain on the beach, he gave me the official green light. After all the negotiations, all the getting to know each other, all the questions about what this would mean for us and the child, we were ready. "Let's make you a baby," he said. And there we were, hugging and smiling, me in an oversized jacket that went down to my knees, embracing this man who was going to give me his sperm. And I thought about how I couldn't wait to tell my child this story one day. When we got back to his car, Alex gave me his executed copy of the contract. And then he disappeared. I didn't hear from him for another 3 days. This might not seem long, but if you're in your late 30s and about to ovulate, and your only other baby option is on indefinite backorder, 3 days is an eternity. I tried not to read into it. Stress is bad for conception. But when Alex finally resurfaced, he left me a message saying, "We need to talk." I sank to the floor. Like every adult on the planet, I knew exactly what that meant. I was about to be dumped. The next morning, as we sat at our regular table at Spurth, Alex looked away and began issuing the usual breakup cliches. "It's not you, it's me. I'm so unsettled in my life right now that I don't know if I can commit. So for your sake, I don't want to string you along." And